The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect that of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another week of Analyze This here on 93.1 FM WTJX. My name is Neville James. And this is your NPR station here in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And you know how we do things here in the Virgin Islands here on this station. We need a weather preview. And we got Mr. David Sanchez from the National Weather Service over there in San Juan. Good morning, Mr. Sanchez. How are you?
Good morning. All good.
Everything is good. The weather is beautiful here. It's nice and calm in St. Croix. How's it like over there?
Yeah, St. Croix and mainland Puerto Rico, it's quite beautiful this morning, mostly sunny skies, but across the northern VIs, St. Thomas and St. John, we're going to have partly cloudy skies and some light showers through the day, and it's going to continue at least through tonight. We have some patches of low-level clouds and showers across the Atlantic, and winds have turned more from the east-northeast, and that's going to push all that cloudiness and shower activity mainly across the northern islands today and tomorrow.
We still got that pressure system out there in the Atlantic?
Yeah, it's reestablishing itself. We have a new system rolling out of the East Coast, and we're going to see an increase in the trade winds, so expect breezy conditions at least through much of the week, and just the high pressure dominating and bringing areas of clouds from time to time. Mainly across the northern islands, and St. Croix should be on the dry side through much of the forecast period through the week.
Y Culebra y Vieques?
Culebra and Vieques, they're going to be on and off. Culebra might get some afternoon showers that develop from the northern islands, and Vieques should be a little bit more clear overall, similar to St. Croix.
What about the marine advisory for our boaters here in the region?
Yeah, so as the winds increase, that's going to create choppy conditions, and we have small craft advisories in effect mostly for the northern and Caribbean waters and across the passages also. We expect that choppy seas between 6 to 8 feet to continue through much of the week. Also, we have a moderate risk of recurrence right now for all the islands. It might increase tomorrow to high, mainly for the northwestern beaches of St. Thomas.
We're looking at the same for the BVA in addition to St. Thomas and St. John?
Yeah, they should experience more cloudiness and scattered shower activity. But overall, same water pattern for the northern VIs. And as the winds there increase, you're going to have more choppy seas across the coastal areas.
What is it about the waterway between St. Croix and St. Thomas and St. John, why we get different weather pattern in the northern VA as opposed to St. Croix? And it's only 40 miles away.
It's just that the high pressure is just dominating, and it's like the base of the high pressure just lingers more in favor north of the region, and that's going to favor like this continuous wind flow of like a road wave or a highway of showers and breezy winds. And then St. Croix, and similar to the south side of Puerto Rico, they're going to remain mostly dry. It's just the Caribbean still too hot and dry overall.
So you're saying northern Puerto Rico will experience different weather than southern Puerto Rico?
That's correct.
So Arecibo and Veja Baja and all that stuff up there up north, they're going to be more wet and Ponce and Yauco and all that stuff down south, they're going to be dry?
That's correct. We're going to experience more rainfall across eastern northeastern Puerto Rico and some passing showers, mainly over north central Puerto Rico, and then the best chance of showers over western Puerto Rico each afternoon.
So
But the south side should remain completely dry.
So the mountain range in the middle of the island in Puerto Rico affects the weather in the south compared to the north?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, that's interesting. That's interesting. Now, quickly, about a month ago, we could have seen, a friend of mine sent me a picture. We saw Junque clear as day from St. Croix. And now we can't see Junque at all.
Yeah, no, you might see it could see it maybe by the end of the week.
End of the week?
Maybe by Friday during the day. Mm-hmm. Looks like to be the driest day in the forecast so far. And, you know, we should have a nice break between like 9 in the morning, 1 p.m.
On Friday morning?
Yeah, on Friday morning, yes.
So we should be able to have better visibility here in the
region? Yeah, that's correct. If the forecast holds as it is right now, we should see better skies. But then during the weekend, that's good to point out that we have a trough moving over us, and that's going to increase cloudiness and shower activity again. But we don't expect to cause like flooding issues across the area like, in general.
Well, we typically reach out to you guys on Monday to get the weekly preview. Then we check back in on Friday to get a weekend preview. So we'll check back in again on Friday morning to update
the weekend.
The weekend, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying right now for our boaters, be careful.
Yeah, be careful through most of the week. Exercise caution across the coastal waters of the island. Mm-hmm. If you go like about maybe 10 miles offshore. Just know that you might encounter seas between 6 to 8 feet.
6 to 8 feet, okay. To where in Puerto Rico?
Same weather pattern in general.
No, are you to where is the Puerto Rico? Tú. Are you from Puerto Rico? You?
Yes, I'm from Puerto Rico.
What part of Puerto Rico are you from?
I have family in San Juan and in Aguada on the west coast of the island.
Aguada, okay, that's over there heading towards Mayagüez and San Germán.
A few municipalities north of Mayagüez.
Oh, north of Mayagüez, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Or just south of Aguadilla, if you know where it's Aguadilla.
Yeah, Aguadilla, that's the northwest.
Yeah, the northwest coast, exactly there.
Oh, right. El Rincón.
Yeah, between Aguadilla and Rincón, where Aguada is.
Okay, cool. Well, David Sanchez, nice talking to you. Thank you very much for the weather preview.
Same to you.
We appreciate that, and we'll tell the boaters to be careful. Waters could be anywhere from 6 to 8 feet, right, as you said?
Yeah, take care.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot. That's David Sanchez from the National Weather Service giving us a weekly preview, and then we'll check back with the Weather Service on Friday. We got Kyle Fleming checking in about 8:20 after the first break. He's going to give us a lay people breakdown of what actually is going on in Texas and parts of the Southwest. You know, it's been inundating the news about what's taking place down there as it relates to energy. And, you know, we're not technocrats, so we need our energy man to break it down for us so we can have a good understanding. We know that, you know, people are struggling, but we want to get him to break down grid, you know, and connectivity and how that all works. And I'm going to ask him a question about how they connect the grid and how it impacts everybody. And actually, I'm going to pull up a story. I remember in 2003 when that power outage went off in the northeast part of New York City in particular, and it reached as far as Ohio. So I wanted to ask him about that. And I know, you know, of course, the more people on a grid, the less load for certain areas, but at the same time, the more people could get affected when the grid goes down. So we want to talk about that. And they've been taking some shots about renewable energy, saying that it wouldn't have worked and all that. So, and of course, you know, I got some politics involved there as well. But so we're going to break that down at 8:20. Let me do the COVID numbers as of through Saturday, because, you know, Sunday, they ain't collecting no data, taking a break and recalibrating so they could crank it back up this morning. Good morning, Janesta. How are you? Through Saturday, 46,380 people tested, 108 pending. So of the 46,272 confirmed tests, we got 2,579 positives, 43,693 negatives. We have 2,465 recovered. Our actives through Saturday night was at 89. And the death number remains at 25. Okay? Now to break down the daily numbers on Friday, St. Croix had 102 negatives and 3 positives. St. Thomas had 101 negatives and 5 positives. and St. John had three negatives and one positives. So in the aggregate, the Virgin Islands had 206 negatives and 9 positives on Friday. Now, Saturday's numbers, we had 26 negatives and 2 positives on St. Croix, 103 negatives and 2 positives on St. Thomas. St. Thomas trending in the right direction. No data for St. John. So, for Saturday, we had 129 negatives and 4 positives. So that's a 32-1 ratio. We liken that. So between Friday and Saturday, we had 335 negatives and 15 positives and 13 positives. So let me see. 13 times 10 is 130. 13 times 20 is 260. And then you got another 75 on top of that. So that's about, 25. That's about a 25 plus to 1 ratio. Definitely liking that. COVID tracking project. Yesterday's numbers, 1.2 million people tested. 58,000 cases. That's still 5% or thereabouts, right under, 60,000 have been 5%, right under 5%. Hospitalizations down to 56,159, liking that. And the death number for yesterday was 1,286. Let me look back next for last week. The death number was 1,363 at the 15th. And the hospitalizations at that point was at 67,000. So it's down now to 56,000. So we're heading in the right direction. More than 1,000 a day. We had 11,000 less hospitalizations over the last week. That's excellent. The big number, though. According to Worldometer, 28,765,423 cases, 511,133 deaths. However, listening to Morning Edition on NPR this morning, they're using Johns Hopkins numbers. New York Times has the death number at 498,650. So they were saying sometime today, we're going to go over that half a million. Number in terms of loss of life in America. New York Times has the positive cases at 28.1 million. That rough. And the marketplace, the Dow closed at 31,494.32. That was absolutely flat. 0.98 was the movement on the big number, 0.00% change. Had 12 companies saw gains, 18 saw losses. Now, over the weekend, we had some issues with airplanes. There was this one clip where an engine was on fire, and it landed, emergency landed over Denver, right on a wing. And then another one yesterday where a window opened, and someone was sucked through the window, so. We'll keep an eye on that. And Boeing had a great day on Friday. Boeing was actually up 8.99%. So we'll see what takes place today as a result of what took place over the weekend with our airlines. So you got to keep an eye on that. Like I said, the Dow closed at 31,494. I think it's going to hover around that number. By the way, President Biden did sign the emergency declaration for a number of counties. I think it's like 77 counties in Texas. Governor Abbott wanted it for 254, and that hasn't happened. So we'll take a break. We'll get Director Fleming to call in, and we'll talk about connectivity and energy and how it all works and why people in Texas are going through that tragedy right now. And we got to give AOC some props when we come back as well. We'll be back right after this.
It's a new year, New Year's resolutions, new financial plan. At Bank of St. Croix, we offer a suite of consumer and business services, including home and auto loans. With online banking, you can bank with us from anywhere 24/7. Bank of St. Croix has two locations, one in Gallows Bay, 340-773-8500, and one in Peters Rest, 340-713-8500. Bank of St. Croix, bankofstcroix.com.
Now more than ever, employee safety and health is essential. As the owner or manager of an organization or business, how do you keep your workplace safe and employees healthy? Help is available. UVI Safety in Paradise program provides free occupational safety and health audits of workplace hazards and programs. You'll get a free assessment, guidance, and training to help you protect your workers and reduce costs due to accidents and illness. Always confidential, always free. For details, visit safety.uvi.edu.
Hi, it's Maria. Maria Hinojosa from Latino USA. You have so much information at your fingertips. Don't you sometimes feel overwhelmed by it all? Here at Latino USA, we know that your time is valuable, which is why our team prides itself on producing original stories that you won't hear anywhere else. Check us out and share us with your friends and family. Thanks for listening.
Latino USA, Saturdays at 6 a.m. and again at 4 p.m. on WTJX 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
And we are back here on Analyze This. And Mr. Fleming.
Good morning. How are you?
What's going on, guy?
Good, man. Good, man.
Director, get
back into the week. So.
Director Energy, yeah. You're supposed to make an appearance next week, Friday, but as fate would have it, we need you now. natural disaster took place about a week ago, and it got people reeling over there in the Lone Star State.
Most definitely, in a way that they haven't seen in quite some time.
You've been following it?
Oh, yeah, very closely, very closely. Texas is actually, the power grid in Texas is a kind of a unique system in of itself. So I follow it pretty closely on a reoccurring basis because there's more similarity to the Virgin Islands in some sense compared to some of the other grids in the U.S.
Well, go ahead and explain. Since you started the conversation, explain that to the public then.
Yeah, so with a lot of the states kind of across the U.S., electrical customers, essentially they may buy power from one utility, but the power actually could come from anywhere. You know, you could be in Massachusetts and getting, you know, hydropower from New York. You could be in California getting solar from Nevada. Whereas in Texas, they actually have essentially the border of Texas contains where all the electricity generation for the state comes from. So they can't rely on any outside power generation outside of what they actually generate within the state lines of Texas, which, once again, high close similarity to the Virgin Islands, despite, obviously, the demand being astronomically higher in Texas, of course, than the Virgin Islands.
Without a doubt, their population requires that. They're like, what, 35 million people?
Gosh, yeah, I'm horrible with the demographic, but yeah, they're definitely up there. I mean, everything's bigger in Texas. We know that.
gosh, yes. Now, in 2003, there was a blackout in New York, and it impacted 8 states and Ontario, Canada. Of course, you know, Ontario is right across the border from a number of states, from Michigan all the way to New York. Matter of fact, probably even more states as well. What is it about the connectivity that the states have decided? Because in reading the story, they say a tree branch in Cleveland, right? This is interesting, right? A tree branch in Cleveland is what caused the whole thing to go down, and 43 million people were impacted as a result. So explain that for us, if you will, the connectivity and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what it ends up being with a lot of these type of outages, especially when you look at it at the national scale, it's oftentimes a domino effect. Mm-hmm. Where you could have one inciting incident that then, you know, it kind of triggers a kind of worst case scenario of successive reactions. And I think, you know, but even to those degrees, oftentimes when those type of vulnerabilities are identified, you know, they're generally quickly remedied. I'm sure that a tree branch in Cleveland will never cause that type of outage again.
But I'm glad you went there, because they said all electricity disappeared when an overgrown tree branch hit a power line in Cleveland and a utilities company's alarm system failed. So you're absolutely on point, where they have certain mechanisms in place in the event incidents like this happen and the alarm system failed, which caused everything to go down.
Right, right. And then it becomes a trickle down of that next failure then can trigger another reaction. And really what happened in Texas, for example, I mean, you know, they had a very similar kind of cascading effect of, you know, the winter storms came in and obviously made it very, dropped the temperature significantly. So what you have is across the state, you know, from north to south, you have people trying to, you know, turn the heat up, the thermostats in their home, trying mm-hmm. to heat their home. So that's actually increasing the electrical demand. At the same time, the power plants throughout the state were having trouble meeting the demand, because they're also dealing with the very low temperatures that are compromising the operation of their facilities. So you have a growing demand, and you don't have the power plants not able to supply. And at one point, they had to look at the system in order to create a balance, and you have to start selectively reducing your demand by turning people off, which is exactly what happened throughout Texas last week.
So break that down again. You have cold weather coming in, right? Extreme cold weather, too. And as a result, an increase in load, right? Because everybody's adjusting as a result of the cold weather. And because of this load increase, the companies, the energy companies, ain't had the capacity to deal with all this load increase. That's basically what it does, right?
That's essentially what happened. And really why, I mean, probably on any other given day, it wouldn't be as much of an issue if the cold weather wasn't actually compromising the power plant's operation as well. So if the power plant could run under its normal operating conditions, you probably wouldn't have seen as much of a challenge. But because the cold weather was actually challenging the operation of the power plant itself, while also more demand, more loads are being, you know, asked of it to provide, that's where you see that cascading effect of selective turning customers off to basically save the system from fully collapsing.
Now, the finger pointing, the politics involved in it, where they're saying that...
Oh, man.
Yeah, what they're saying, look, renewables are proving that they can't handle the load. How do we respond to that?
Well, really, a lot of it comes, well, for one, you have to be able to take these things with a grain of salt, right? Because, of course, Texas being a very very conservative state, but also a state that a lot of people profit from the oil and gas industry within that state. And so, you know, of course, when these type of, you know, any type of challenge comes, like the politics of it, they're going to always want to, you know, cast a veil of security around their own interest. But really, if you look at there's been a number of reports now, even though there's still the investigation is still ongoing, that show that the natural gas and coal power plants really are what make up the majority of power production in Texas, and those were compromised by the cold in ways, one, on the fuel supply. You know, moving natural gas in very cold temperatures is a difficult process, because it actually changes the composition of the material. And then you also had, not only did the power plants need the supply of natural gas, but also homes that are trying to heat their homes also. So once again, that trickle-down cascading effect of everybody needing this energy source and the conditions making it harder to access. So, you know, at the end of the day, if we really look at the way power is broken down in Texas, while yes, there's a significant amount of renewables, natural gas and coal power plants still produce the primary or the main power source for the state, and those facilities certainly had a number of challenges to overcome during this temperature, and it wasn't exclusive to the renewable energy. So it's just a matter of looking at it with a grain of salt, because special interests are always going to exist in these type of discussions.
No, so the question is, right, the governor, right, the governor is saying that the environmental movement is part of the problem, right, where we don't want emissions up in the air and all that stuff. And they're insisting that the frozen wind turbines show the limits of alternative energy sources. Of course, this is, according to CNN, this is a gross exaggeration. Why is that exaggeration?
Well, it's because, for one, we have, you know, Texas isn't the only place that is subject, well, Texas is very, very rarely subject to this type of weather pattern. However, there are places all across the U.S. where these, all across the world, where these type of weather patterns are common, as well are the presence of renewable energy in the form of wind turbines as well. So I think when we look at the situation from what it actually is, and it's not to say that these things are impossibilities that, you know, Texas has on Earth. You have certain systems that aren't necessarily, that are intended for a place like Texas, that you don't design those systems with the same considerations you design them to be installed in Scandinavia or in, you know, upper, you know, northern Canada. You have certain type of restriction or conditions. And actually the same thing for the power plants. Even some of the power plants, they're not designed or winterized in the sense of having, over-engineered to operate in Texas, because you're not assuming the worst-case scenario is going to be there. However, the possibility does exist, and this is a kind of reminder of that. So it's more so about how these systems are designed and incorporated in the environments where they normally function. And sometimes these other challenges, these external challenges, will upend even a normal operation.
Now, they have an independent organization that operates the Texas power grid, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. You familiar with how this whole thing set up and why it's set up like that? I know you spoke about the borders and all that stuff, but why is this thing so unique down there in Texas? And it's not just basically companies calling shots.
Yeah, so I mean, ERCOT is what is the kind of shorthand for that. For that commission that regulates the power industry, and you know, for them, it really just ends up being a way in which you can have a lot of different players all contributing to the, you know, to the overall power system. So instead of, you know, a big difference would be, you know, where we have WAPA here as the primary power producer, also the company responsible for delivering that electricity to your home or business. As well as, you know, dealing with the billing and, you know, sale of that electricity. In Texas, for example, you know, you have a number of different entities that are just focused on producing power, and then you have different companies altogether that are focused on actually delivering and selling it to customer. So ERCOT, for example, gets in. What they do is, you know, since you don't have one company kind of responsible for everything, this is the agency or the regulatory body that makes sure all the different players involved in energy production in Texas are both providing a quality service and affordable product to the customers of Texas. So it's a very different structure from how we see, you know, electricity, at least, or utilities kind of occur here in the Virgin Islands. But you have these singular bodies that oversee a wide range of different players that are all trying to participate in the power market. And that's why they have these kind of standalone regulatory bodies, whereas we kind of, our system is just a little bit more centralized.
Okay, and so in reading this article here on CNN, and follow me here, it says, to understand what's happening right now in Texas and who's to blame, you have to go back to 1935, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Federal Power Act, which governed electricity sharing and sales between the states. Basically, it allowed the federal government to regulate states who brought power in from outside their state lines. Texas, never a fan of federal intrusion, set up its own power grid system, split between northern and southern Texas, to avoid any federal involvement. That led eventually to the formation of ERCOT in 1970. And this strange fact, there are three power grids in the United States. The Eastern Power Grid, the Western Power Grid, and, well, Texas. So this is what you were talking about earlier. So in reality, they build their own they build their own carriage, and now the carriage broke down.
Well, it's the reality of wanting to be, you know, that the desire to be fully independent, but, you know, also struggling to realize that there's challenges to that absolute isolation and independence as well.
But you know, that actually applies to governance as well, right? For example, you see, we everything that we look at in the micro, it actually impacts in the macro as well, right? For example, there are those here who want independence, but when the independence comes, lack of dependence. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. Yes, absolutely.
And now, what we're learning now, this is an educational thing for everybody. What we're learning now is that Texas, because they were so big, right? As a matter of fact, keep in mind, they were our biggest state until 1959, right? When Alaska came in, right? Along with Hawaii in 1959. Mm-hmm. So they probably felt, well, because we were the biggest at one point, that, you know, we could do things on our own. And look at them now. This is enlightening.
Texas, I felt like, was always one of those states that was ready to secede at the drop of a coin. And I feel like they've always been kind of setting themselves
They've been talking secession for the longest. But watch them now. Well, my peace. Go ahead.
You know what's very interesting? I was having this conversation this past week. In regards to, if you just look at the reaction to, you know, this was just 1 week of, one week of outages, and in terms of the, you know, the national recognition that something like this has garnered, obviously the scale of it, you know, tells you, but, you know, this is, I think it raises a really important point, you know, and it's something that we think about a lot here in the Virgin Islands. We definitely think about it as, you know, part of the WAPA board as well. Is, you know, looking at the critical nature in which, energy challenges are viewed on the national scale, and ensuring that we're applying the same level of priority to the challenges that we encounter here in the territory, which happen on a far more reoccurring basis. And so I think that this moment in, kind of American, history right now is certainly, I think, a resonating moment for also the way we need to start looking at some of the priorities we apply to our challenges here.
But no, I going to take it a step further, right? They're bawling for their mother after 1 week, and we have been here up to 6 months to 8-9 months after hurricane and they got no power. We wish them bad on them or no. What I'm saying is you find out about yourself individually and collectively during times like this. Like, anybody could drive a paved road, but you got to be able to navigate the potholes, Director Fleming.
100%.
Wow. 100%. Now, when we come back, right, because we're heading towards the break, right, we want to talk about the solutions. Do we need some, would you suggest some type of modification in the event of this, the worst case scenario being realized, like what we're dealing with now with Texas? I mean, I know that they believe they're big and they could do things on their own, but at the end of the day, we got to do things to protect ourselves from ourselves, don't we?
Of course. And I think sometimes, you know, we could talk about it more, but, you know, these things, these considerations, I think they're always on the table, but obviously the costs associated with them are also on the table. And I think sometimes these worst case scenarios makes those actual consequences more tangible, which oftentimes lead to swifter action.
Good. We're going to take a break right now. We come back and we start to talk, because we can't allow politics and to get to the point where it's undermining basic common sense. This is crazy. Director Kyle Fleming, join us. We're talking about the energy situation in Texas and other surrounding states because it's not limited. Good morning, Lorna Nichols. Kyle, Lorna, say hello. So, yeah, we'll be back right after this break.
Hours ago, halfway around the world, the day has already begun.
Tens of thousands of people in Venezuela.
Britain is leaving the European Union.
Everyone was just running. People were crying. They were in tears. And we didn't know what was happening. Police kept telling us to move back, move back.
The thousands of protesters marched along a route.
When you need to know where the world went while you weren't looking. Morning Edition. Listen every morning.
Morning Edition, weekdays at 6 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
On Point represents democracy in action every day with the sharpest guests and the sharpest listener calls. Our audiences often know as much as we do, connecting us in ways you won't find anywhere else. I'm David Folkenflik. Hear what you don't always see. Join Meghna Chakrabarty and me for the next On Point.
On Point weekdays at 11 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
I'm Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday. It gives me great pleasure when I hear from someone like you who listens to our show and they say, you know, I was in a bad frame of mind when I got up, but I listened to your show and I'm not now. I think I can face the world. And then I heard something on your show that kind of changed my mind, changed my heart. I think that's why we're in business. Weekend Edition Saturday. Listen every weekend.
Weekend Edition Saturdays at 9 a.m. and Sundays at 8 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
And we are back here on Analyze This, and we're talking energy this morning, and we want to stay ahead of the curve. Of course, you know, we deal with situations like this as a result of hurricanes, and we got Kyle Fleming, the Director of Energy, here joining us to give the right kind of perspective here on Analyze This, because that's what we do. We analyze things. We're not in the business of you know, melee and gossip, even though we like a little melee now and again. I mean, it's a Caribbean thing and we like it, but in this case, we want the public to be a little bit more educated. So we've learned, right, that that Texas, for the most part, not the entire state, for the most part, they do their own thing as it relates to energy, providing energy for its state residents, and that there are two other grids, the Eastern Grid and the Western Grid. As a matter of fact, reading here, right, El Paso, right at the western tip of the state, gets power from the Western Interconnection, which is why the city has been saved from the most brutal effects of the power outages. Isn't it safe to assume, right, even though we're trying to stay away from MLA, that some of those different smaller towns and counties are going to look now to get connected to either the Eastern or the Western grid based on what happened, Director Fleming?
I mean, I feel like you're certainly at a point where no options are going to be left off the table, especially when it comes to resilience. Yeah, I think energy resilience is something that
Your father child for sure. That's an excellent political answer. You know, I like that.
Learn from the best. You know, learn from the best.
Yeah, you're your papa picnic. Like we don't say locally, you're your papa picnic, which is an excellent answer. No options are off the table. You go there. I like that. But go ahead. But you're absolutely right. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. So I think the reality is the priority once again when it pertains to energy resiliency is something that nobody's going to overlook. And it's even, you know, it may be to the point where you might not even necessarily be interconnected on a permanent basis, but you know, you may see entities looking even for alternative options where there's possibilities to interconnect to alternative source in the event that there is another failure of their existing infrastructure. And I think that side of things is you know, we see that here as well, right? We see that in the Virgin Islands where, you know, you have people who will have either their own on-site generator or, you know, they have a solar and battery system, but they still remain, you know, connectivity to the grid because, you know, we're looking for as much redundancy as possible so that we know we have a high chance of having the energy resiliency that we require. So whether that happens on a larger scale in Texas, I most definitely can see a broader spectrum of options being explored because even though this is a once in a maybe every 10 or 20 year occurrence, the end of the day is that, you know, people's lives were at risk. And, you know, I'm sure there's people who did pass during this event. And, you know, those are risks that you can't even take, even if it doesn't happen on a reoccurring basis.
Now, Lorna sent me a text message in the form of an opinion from Republican Nebraska governor, who's a Republican, Pete Ricketts, whose state has seen smaller scale energy problems and said was unacceptable to have rolling blackouts in this country. I mean, this is the United States of America. We're not some developing nation. And basically, right, this is a microcosm of what's been going on with our health crisis with COVID-19, where it's shown that there are areas where we are frail and fragile, and we need to actually come back home and start really looking at our infrastructure to get it to where we need to be, because we can't be touting ourselves as being all that and then suffering like we're suffering now, Director Fleming. Right. It looks bad.
Most definitely. And I think that's where, you know, I mean America as a whole has been on the forefront of the, you know, the energy revolution at almost every phase of expansive growth in recent history. And, you know, the energy realm is no different, especially in the wide range of impacts we've been having from both the fossil fuel and the renewable energy front. But at the end of the day, resiliency is there because you can have as many sources as possible. But if you can't actually stay energized due to these type of challenges, you know, you're still no better off than you were before. And so that's where when it comes to once again, expanding the portfolio of options. And, you know, I think that the challenges that have come, you know, it was very interesting to me to see how much challenge has come under the challenges towards renewable energy has come about relative to, you know, just last week's occurrence. I wasn't expecting the politics to go that route. But at the end of the day, I can't be fully surprised, given how everybody's got, you know, different dogs in the fight. However, I think it becomes clear in these type of situations where diversity is where we really need to look at. You know, I think we can certainly expand a lot more as it pertains to, you know, renewables on many fronts. I think we just have to also keep in mind these type of worst case scenarios. That's why people sometimes don't necessarily see the value of modeling. They're like, well, let's just do it. Let's just get it done. Unfortunately, sometimes when you just have that approach to problem solving, you miss out on some of these, you know, these kind of worst case scenarios that you didn't account for. And then you find yourself in the thick of it. And then you're trying to kind of react instead of be more proactive in your planning. So I think effective planning with all these type of worst case scenarios in mind, we can certainly find the mix of multiple energy sources, especially expansion of the renewable side, to meet a lot of these demands as well.
Now, since you went there, we'll talk some politics, right? The young lady out of New York, AOC, right? Mm-hmm. Representative Cortez out there out of New York, and she's actually from the Bronx. She represents a constituency from the Bronx and Queens, right? She done raised $5 million already. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez announced tonight, this is last night, 9 hours ago, that her fundraising efforts for a Texas Relief Fund just hit $5 million, right? So, no, I see us, and you know how the game is. When your political foes slip up and you see an opportunity, you jump on it. At the same time, in the middle of the week, Big Mouth Ted, what happened on plane going to Cancun, right? And he get catch. Right, so it looked bad, right? You must feel a way where you live in the state of Texas. You're in, let's just pick a city, Corpus Christi, right? And you got state senators playing politics, right? And a representative, not even a U.S. senator, a representative from a mixed constituency in the Bronx and Queens, finding money for you.
Yeah,
Huh? And that's the politics that's going on right now. You're checking so and then they show a picture with Ted Cruz trying to help somebody put water in the car and them kind of thing yesterday. A photo up. Look now, having been in the political arena, right? You got to be careful with optics. You could get crushed if your optics ain't correct.
Well, absolutely, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think Ted Cruz took as much blowback last week as he did, because I mean, it's really the picture that circulated that really drove that storm. If it was just the headlines alone, people may not have even believed it or paid enough attention. But you have all those pictures in the airport; it's indisputable, and you know, especially the timing of everything. Especially, and granted, I mean, it's not to say that you know Ted Cruz is going to be you know behind the operator table, you know, turning people's power back on. But at the end of the day, there's still a role that, as a leader, that they play in making sure that their constituents are being taken care of, and they know that that's not the time for them to be absent. And I like the way that the AOC has taken, especially because you know her and Ted are best friends, long time best friends.
Yes, sir.
She didn't hesitate to make sure that I'm sure if it was another state, she probably wouldn't have gone as aggressively in campaigning.
Of course not. But the opportunity presented itself, and Teddy went. Teddy, as soon as she heard Teddy hop on a plane. Right? She said, let me do this thing. But let me ask this question, right? Are they overreacting? Isn't this just a natural disaster because of the weather? Now, I know this happened in 2011, right? Something like this happened 10 years ago, right? And, of course, you would want to be prepared in the event the worst-case scenario represents itself again. But are we overreacting? Like for example, with us, right? We deal with hurricanes. We know they're coming. There's but so much you can do to prepare yourself.
Well, I think we definitely as Virgin Islands, I think we've become resilient in our own way when it comes to dealing with these type of inconveniences. And I think we can certainly look at through the lens of you know what we have to regularly subject ourselves to, even outside of you know hurricane season, the challenges that we encounter on the energy front. And so, you know, I think the lens that we look at it, it's very easy to see it that way, you know, from a, you know, Texas perspective. Obviously, you know, they're just not accustomed to those type of inconveniences. And I think that's where I think the strong reaction, I think also the extreme weather conditions, if it was just even that 2003 outage you mentioned in New York, you know, that was, I believe, in the summer, or maybe like spring.
August,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't recall. I imagine if there was a heat wave involved, maybe you might have, you know, that might have been a bit stronger reaction. But I think it was more so just the inconvenience of not having a readily available resource. I think the severe cold coupled on top of this outage, I think, is really what's highlighted it more because of the additional, like, you know, we could be, you know, we might lose power here and be uncomfortable, but it's very different to be not having any, you know, energy resources in a potentially life or death, you know, situation. And when you talk about the kind of temperatures people were subject to there, you know, I think that's where the narrative really, really grew to the level of concern it did on the national scale. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think we should be treating energy resilience in every capacity, because we talk about the cold. We haven't talked about even imagine how many people have, you know, life-saving equipment in their homes that rely on energy, right? And that doesn't matter whether it's cold or
that's
not.
Right.
That happens
that's
everywhere.
That's right. That's right.
You know, and you know, and even sometimes on a communication front, you know, sometimes there's you know life and death communication that needs to be to be mobilized. That you know, the absence of energy can certainly compromise that. So I think at the end of the day, it seems like these should be avoidable situations, and I think that's the way it's viewed that we should be able to find alternative ways to ensure that these type of situations don't occur. And I think that's where some of the pressure really comes into making sure that even in these events, the focus really lies heavily on how do we avoid these from continuing to be a challenge moving forward, which once again, that's the type of priority I think that, you know, we need to, I think because we become very complacent in some of the challenges that we and inconveniences we're accustomed to down here, we also don't put as much pressure oftentimes on, you know, demanding immediate response or immediate, like, you know, transformation. And I think that's something that, you know, we can certainly learn from these examples that have occurred over the last week to once again reinforce why we shouldn't even be, you know, why we should be more unwilling to accept even the challenges and inconveniences that we come to so accustomed to here.
We so desensitized to the blow that we learn how to deal with it because of our excellent levels of resilience. Let me ask this question: any opinion on why people in Ohio get bills because of the storm in Texas? Why would that be? If that's happening.
So that, you know, I was actually trying to get a better grasp because I've been hearing about people who are getting, you know, bills in the 1,000+ even within Texas, and I was trying to figure out, well, if this event happened last week, how are they even getting bills out so quickly?
Yeah, exactly. What going on? And like we just said, right? I used to hang out in Tongue, right? I used to have a little fun. A little bit of wagering, right? And at home we used to use, right, when a man make a mistake, right, used to say, you're studying teeth, right? Right? You're studying teeth. This thing happened last week and people done game bills already? What kind of games, what kind of smart man thing is this, Director Fleming?
I don't know the full intricacies of utility billing systems nationwide, but I know for a fact something that happened last week here, you know, for example, a waffle wouldn't translate to something that would show up on your bill the following week. So, unless they're doing weekly billing or daily billing, I'm not sure how, you know, how those challenges are or how those rates are being issued that quickly.
I apologize. It wasn't Ohio. It's higher bills, right? How they don't gain higher bills already? Cause they already anticipating people bills gonna be 1,000 times more than it normally would be because of this tragedy.
Well, you know, what one of the things that does happen in the states that doesn't happen here from a billing standpoint, and it varies across different jurisdictions, but some places have what they call demand charges. So you're not just charged, you know, the energy that you use for the month, but also if you're, say you're running like really high power equipment, whether it's for your business or even, you know, a large AC, HVAC system for your home, you also get charged on like the peak, so the most amount of power that you're using at any given time. That also determines a certain rate, and that happens. So that's not something that we utilize here. We just bill for the energy used per the month.
Yeah, one lick. The Vodans is one lick kill dick. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So whether it's at 12 o'clock in the afternoon or 12 o'clock in the morning, it's the same rate. But stateside, it could be very different. Sometimes you have time of use. It's different between 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the morning versus 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the afternoon. And then you have all these different peak charges that can occur as well. So with everything that's been going on in the system, there may have been you know, some of those conditions or things that maybe people weren't thinking about because they just wanted to have their heat on. And so they weren't thinking about all these different, you know, rate structures. That'd be the only thing I could think of that may get people to higher rates outside of the norm, given the last week's occurrence. But that I can't speak to with absolute confidence. I will.
No, but I'm glad you went there. See, I'm learning again. You know, how do demand charges work? They say demand is a measure of how much power a customer uses at a given time. Utilities apply demand charges based on the maximum amount of power that a customer use in any interval, typically 15 minutes during the billing cycle. And demand charges usually apply to commercial and industrial customers who tend to have higher peak loads than residential customers. I say hello, Alona. Yeah, what we're gonna do is we're gonna hold on to you for a little bit more. Ronnie Russell gonna be joining the conversation in hour number two. So we'll take a break now. We come back. Hold you off about 5 or 10 minutes into hour number two, if you will. That good?
That's perfect.
Okay, good. And then we'll transition over to Ronnie, and then we'll talk about the local energy and how we could learn from what's taking place in Texas right now. Analyze this. Kyle Fleming, Director of Energy, joining us to talk about the energy crisis in Texas as a result of the winter storms. We'll be back right after this break.
The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect that of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.